You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
All rise. First now in session, Honorable Stephen W. Boyce, Judge presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. All right, Mr. Bailiff, if you'd like to have our jurors brought in, please. I'm sorry, we do need to take up one matter outside the presence of the jurors. If they're ready, it will take a few moments. Apologies. Okay, we are going to go on the record on case CR 22-21-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. We began a special sentencing proceeding under Idaho's death penalty statute yesterday. At the conclusion of the return of a verdict in this case, the court gave some preliminary instruction to the jurors. They convened for the evening. We're starting again with that hearing today on this special sentencing proceeding. The court has been advised by defense counsel of an intent to potentially not present mitigation. And I have, in a closed sealed hearing, inquired with counsel on a proffer to cover that. However, I also want to go through and determine whether or not there's a knowing and voluntary waiver of that right on the record and do that outside the presence of the jurors. So, Mr. Daybell, let me just outline your rights here for you briefly. In this special sentencing proceeding, you do have the right to both present mitigation and also a right of allocution that can be exercised at the conclusion of the proceeding before the jury deliberates. There are a couple of instructions that would be provided to the jurors. I'll read an instruction called mitigation, and it reads as follows. A mitigating factor is any fact or circumstance relating to the crime or to the defendant's state of mind or condition at the time of the crime or to his character, background, or record that tends to suggest that a sentence other than death should be imposed. A mitigating factor does not have to constitute a defense, excuse, or justification for the crime, nor does it even have to reduce the degree of the defendant's blame for the crime. My instructions given at the end of the trial phase that you are not to allow sympathy for the defendant to enter your deliberations do not apply at this sentencing phase. Mitigating factors may include any fact or circumstance that inspires sympathy, compassion, or mercy for the defendant. Evidence supporting the existence of a mitigating factor may come from the trial phase or the sentencing phase, whether produced by the defendant or the state. One other instruction that will be given is the defendant's right to allocution, and that reads, the defendant has the right to personally address you. This is called the right of allocution. Allocution is not made under oath and not subject to cross-examination. The law provides that these statements are something that the defendant is allowed to present to you as mitigation. You may consider these statements in your deliberations. So, Mr. Pryor, I've discussed this with you on the record already, but you have explained the right of mitigation and allocution to your client. Is that correct?
I have, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Daybell, the purpose of these rights is to potentially present evidence to the jury that could result in them finding that the death penalty should not be imposed in your case. Do you understand that?
I do.
All right. And I'm also advised then that you do not intend to, despite the preparation of mitigation from your attorney, you don't intend to present that evidence at this hearing. Is that your choice?
That is my choice.
Has anyone coerced or pressured you personally to make that choice?
No.
And do you feel like you're thinking clearly this morning as you make that choice?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that is your right, Mr. Daybell. So thank you for putting that on the record for the court before we brought the jurors in at this time. Then we are going to proceed with the remainder of this special sentencing proceeding, and we'll have the jurors brought into the courtroom, please.
All right, please. Jury's all present, Counter for Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Please be seated. All right. Good morning, everyone. We're on the record on case CR 22-21-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. I understand we are now on the record with the public here and the jurors much later than anticipated, but the court's been taking up several administrative matters to get to this point. At this time, then, the court's intent is to read some additional instructions to the jurors before any opening statements are made. Is the state prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
And let me just inquire, will the state intend to make an opening statement for this procedure?
Yes, Your Honor.
And will that be you, Ms. Blake?
It will be Mr. Wood.
Mr. Wood, thank you. Is the defense prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And does the defense intend an opening statement?
Yes, Judge, and that will be me.
Thank you, Mr. Pryor. All right. At this time then, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I am going to read you some additional instructions. I'll note that you'll get copies of these to take with you as you deliberate. I read you an instruction yesterday, which was instruction number 3. And the way I read the instruction yesterday had an error in it. So that's been corrected. I'm going to reread it. And the one you get with you will have the correct language. So these instructions are not in any particular order, but they'll come to you in a packet. And again, the order doesn't necessarily matter, but you'll receive each of these. So the first instruction I'm going to read you this morning is as follows. The state of Idaho is seeking the death penalty in this case, alleging aggravating circumstances exist under Idaho law that may allow the death penalty to be imposed. The statutory aggravating circumstances are simply allegations. They are not evidence. You should not be influenced or prejudiced for or against the defendant because the state is seeking the death penalty. The state has alleged the following statutory aggravating circumstances. A, the murder of Tylee Ryan was committed for remuneration, or the defendant employed another to commit the murder for remuneration or the promise of remuneration. B, the murder of Joshua Jackson, hereinafter J.J. Vallow, was committed for remuneration, or the defendant employed another to commit the murder for remuneration or the promise of remuneration. C, the murder of Tamara, hereinafter Tammy Daybell, was committed for remuneration, or the defendant employed another to commit the murder for remuneration or the promise of remuneration. D, the murder of Tylee Ryan was especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, manifesting exceptional depravity. E, the murder of J.J. Vallow was especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, manifesting exceptional depravity. F, the murder of Tammy Daybell was especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, manifesting exceptional depravity. G, by the murder or circumstances surrounding their commission, the defendant exhibited utter disregard for human life. H, the defendant, by his conduct, whether such conduct was before, during, or after the commission of the murders at hand, has exhibited a propensity to commit murder, which will probably constitute a continuing threat to society. If, after considering all the evidence, you unanimously find that one or more of the aggravating circumstances exists beyond a reasonable doubt, you must indicate on the special verdict form by specifically stating what aggravating circumstances or circumstance exists. If, after looking at all the evidence, you unanimously find that there is a reasonable doubt about the existence of a statutory aggravating circumstance, or you cannot unanimously agree on the existence of a statutory aggravating circumstance, you must indicate on the special verdict form that the state has not proven the aggravating circumstance. You must indicate this finding by checking the appropriate line next to such aggravating circumstance or circumstances on the verdict form. Your presiding juror must sign the verdict form. Next instruction. It is presumed that no statutory aggravating circumstance exists in this case. This presumption remains throughout the sentencing phase and during your deliberations. The state has the burden of proving the existence of a statutory aggravating circumstance, and that burden remains on the state throughout the sentencing phase. The defendant is not required to prove the absence of any aggravating circumstance, nor is the defendant required to produce any evidence at all. The state must prove the existence of a statutory aggravating circumstance beyond a reasonable doubt. A reasonable doubt is not a mere possible or imaginary doubt. It is a doubt based on reason and common sense. It may arise from a careful and impartial consideration of all the evidence or from lack of evidence. If after careful and impartial consideration of all the evidence, you are not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt about a statutory aggravating circumstance, it is your duty to find that a statutory aggravating circumstance has not been proven. On the other hand, if after careful and impartial consideration of all the evidence, you are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt about a statutory aggravating circumstance, it is your duty to find that a statutory aggravating circumstance has been proven. Next instruction. A mitigating factor is any fact or circumstance relating to the crime or to the defendant's state of mind or condition at the time of the crime or to his character, background, or record that tends to suggest that a sentence other than death should be imposed. A mitigating factor does not have to constitute a defense, excuse, or justification for the crime, nor does it even have to reduce the degree of the defendant's blame for the crime. My instructions given at the end of the trial phase were that you are not allowed to have sympathy for the defendant or to enter that into your deliberations, and that does not apply at this sentencing phase. Mitigating factors may include any fact or circumstance that inspires sympathy, compassion, or mercy for the defendant. Evidence supporting the existence of a mitigating factor may come from the trial phase or this sentencing phase, whether produced by the defendant or the state. Next instruction, a defendant has a constitutional right not to be compelled to testify. The decision whether to testify is left to the defendant, acting with the advice and assistance of the defendant's lawyer. You must not draw any inference of guilt from the fact that the defendant did not testify during the guilt phase of the trial or during the sentencing phase, nor should this fact be discussed by you or enter into your deliberations in any way. The next instruction, victims have the right to personally address you by making a victim impact statement, which is a statement concerning the victim's personal characteristics and the emotional impact of the murder. A victim impact statement is not made under oath and is not subject to cross-examination. A victim may not make any statements that are characterizations or opinions about the crime, the defendant, or the appropriate sentence, and you should disregard any such comments you may otherwise consider victim impact statements in your deliberations. And my final instruction before we start with the opening arguments is instruction number 7. The defendant has the right to personally address you. This is called the right of allocution. Allocution is not made under oath and is not subject to cross-examination. The law provides that these statements are something that the defendant is allowed to present to you as mitigation. You may consider these statements in your deliberations. All right, that concludes the court's preliminary instructions. At this time, Mr. Wood, I understand you'll be making an opening statement for the state.
Yes, Your Honor. May I approach the jury, and is there a microphone we can use?
Yeah, we'll get you a wireless mic.
Ladies and gentlemen, when we first met during the jury selection process, we spoke with you about what could happen if we got to this phase of the trial. And we spoke with you about some of your thoughts and feelings about if we got to this phase, and we're here. And in that earlier discussion, we talked with you about what happens if a defendant is convicted of first-degree murder or conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. And we talked with you about some of your feelings and your thoughts on that. The discussion we had involved the jury questionnaires that you filled out. And those questionnaires in our conversations dealt with acknowledging that murder in and of itself is not sufficient for the death penalty. That there has to be something else beyond a finding of guilt if you are to impose the death penalty. And the thing that has to be proven to you beyond a reasonable doubt and beyond that finding of guilt, conspiracy to commit murder, are these aggravating circumstances or aggravating factors the judge just mentioned. And we have alleged in this case, in a document that was filed a long time ago, there are multiple aggravating factors that we are going to ask you to find. And the judge read those to you. I'll go back over them in just a moment. In considering those factors, however, we don't have to start all over again. Yesterday, the court read you an instruction that says you may consider and you shall consider all of the evidence presented so far. And so you have to consider everything that you considered in coming to your verdict on the charges of murder and conspiracy to commit murder. We will not be presenting additional evidence to you in this hearing. However, you will hear from multiple victims in this case. Again, you are entitled to consider everything that has been proven to you beyond a reasonable doubt so far. And the judge read these, but I'm going to read them one more time. These are the aggravators that we are going to ask you to find exist beyond a reasonable doubt. The murder of Tylee Ryan was committed for remuneration. The murder of J.J. Vallow was committed for remuneration. The murder of Tammy Daybell was committed for remuneration. The murder of Tylee Ryan was especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, manifesting exceptional depravity. The murder of J.J. Vallow was especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, manifesting exceptional depravity. The murder of Tammy Daybell was especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, manifesting exceptional depravity. That by these murders or circumstances surrounding their commission, that this defendant exhibited utter disregard for human life. That the defendant, by his conduct, whether such conduct was before, during, or after the commission of the murders at hand, has exhibited a propensity to commit murder, which will probably constitute a continuing threat to society. Again, we're going to ask you to make these findings based on the evidence that's already been presented in this case and anything you hear today. And so going forward, as the judge told you, the trial will work like this. If you decide that the state has proven one or more of those aggravators beyond a reasonable doubt, this case then goes back to you. And it is your decision, whether one or more of these aggravators has been proven. And if it has, then you must decide if under these circumstances, imposition of the death penalty would be just or unjust. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wood. That concludes the opening statement from the state. Mr. Pryor, if you'd like to present an opening statement on behalf of your client, you may do so at this time.
And just once more, Judge, may I approach the well?
Yes. Yeah, we're going to adjust a camera as well first. Thank you, Mr. Pryor. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Pryor. Yes.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You know, there's a saying that says you can define someone by who they are now and in the future by what they've done in the past. And only a unusual trajectory or an unusual or startling event can change that trajectory. And I want to talk to you a little bit about Chad Daybell. I want to talk to you a little bit about Sheila Daybell taking the stand and talking about this quiet, reserved, shy young man growing up in Springville, Utah. Springville's a town outside of Salt Lake City, about 50 miles south of Salt Lake City. Chad growing up there was a town of about 15,000 people.
Mr. Pryor, I really much apologize. We're barely picking you up on the mic. I don't know if we want to maybe swap mics or. All right. Thank you, Mr. Pryor. Apologies.
Skill with electronics is showing and has shown throughout this, I guess, correct? Springville, Utah, small town was at the time. I understand now it's 50,000 people. Chad growing up in this small town, quiet, shy, reserved, town of faith, town of religion, grew up in that. We heard Jason William talk about that tight-knit community. Maybe everybody knew each other. And then Chad goes on his mission. I don't know very much. You've gathered that. I don't know very much about the LDS faith. Goes off on a mission, comes back. This is not a mission where you gain worldly experience. It's not a mission where you gain insight into all of the unusual things or the challenges that people have in society, things that many of us experience who maybe grow up in larger metropolitan areas or maybe even big cities or other parts of the country where you get an opportunity to experience other things. This is small town living. And he meets Tammy Douglas, and they get married, and they're married for 29 years. And by anybody's definition, anyone's definition, Tammy and Chad raised five wonderful children, five beautiful children, very deep in their faith, very deep in their commitment to family. And we can say maybe Tammy was the driving force in this. Tammy was the glue that created these wonderful children. But it doesn't just take one parent to do that. You don't raise five wonderful children, five amazing children, with just one parent's input. It takes two parents to do that. It does take two parents to do that. And they did that, much like they shared in the Springville Publishing Company together. They did all of those things together and built this life. And Chad wrote these books. And again, I told you before, you don't have to agree with what he wrote about, but he wrote books about things that interest him. And Jason Gwilliam, Steve Schultz, Emma, Jason talked about Chad, that, and Steve Schultz talked about Chad, deeply involved with the Boy Scouts, deeply involved with his church, a member, a secretary to, and I cannot remember the words, and I will hack him if I say that, but deeply involved with the integral part of his church and his belief. And as Jason Gwilliam talked about it, he said, remember this? When he said, December, Christmas time, something changed. Something changed. What changed in December? Chad got this trajectory that was changing his trajectory. You can judge someone by their past and predict how they're going to be in the future, unless there's an interjecting trajectory that maybe changes the plan. And that trajectory, that bomb that came into his life, was a woman who previously had been married four times. And that bomb brought chaos to Chad Daybell's life. And this worldly man, no, not a worldly man, no experience, the only girlfriend, the only woman, 29 years, from the mission to marriage to five kids. He doesn't have a lot of experience dealing with relationships, dealing with how to interact with people, maybe being manipulated. And we can argue this all day long. But when it comes to personal relationships, he wasn't a worldly man. And on the other hand, the trajectory that's coming through, the trajectory that's flying into this 29-year marriage, is a woman who didn't have one, two, three, four marriages. That's worldly experience. That's a lot of things. There's a lot of things going on there. And then it all changes. The amplification of these religious beliefs, these crazy thoughts, this crazy trail of things. And you've made your decision, and I'm not going to go back on that. But look at where he was. And in Jason Gwilliam's own words, Christmas 2018, what changed? What caused this change? We know what caused the change. You've seen all the evidence. And when I went through the Bois Dire process with you, I used an expression, and some of you may remember this. I don't know if I used it with all of you. I said, everything that glitters is not gold. Lori Vallow glittered. She was not gold. She was the trajectory that changed the plan. You don't go back on 29 years of marriage with nothing as far as a speeding ticket, raising five wonderful children. That takes two parents to do that. And then this trajectory comes in and chaos hits. And all of these things start cascading. And this thing becomes very complicated
and difficult.
Easy. And this small town boy from Springville, Utah, who's residing on a farm with his wife and his family close by in a wonderful community of Rexburg, has this bomb dropped. Suddenly chaos ensues. We have to look back at that. Because when you start talking about how do you predict the future, you go back looking at what the past was, and you examine what Chad Daybell's past was prior to the bomb being dropped, the Lori Vallow bomb being dropped on Chad Daybell's life, and suddenly all of this stuff changing. And you evaluate that and you look back and say, is this a person, if it wasn't for that trajectory coming in and changing the path, is this where we would be going? It's not where we'd be going. That's changed. But you judge what's capable in the future by what you've seen him do with his family, his friends, and this small-knit community of Springville, Utah, and raising these five absolutely wonderful children. Thank you.
All right, that'll conclude the opening statements. At this point of the proceedings, then, the state is entitled to put on evidence in support of aggravating factors? Does the state intend to put on any evidence in support of aggravating factors?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Is the defense going to put on any evidence in support of mitigation, Mr. Pryor?
No, Judge.
All right. At this time, the next stage of these proceedings then would be for the state to introduce any victim impact statements it may have. Is the state going to do that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. You can commence with victim impact statements. The court would note they are governed by statute, somewhat limited in scope, and I believe counsel has tailored these to comport with the statute. So with that in mind, Ms. Blake, if you'd like to call in order your first impact statement victim.
The state would call Ron Douglas.
Very well. Okay. If you'll give us just a moment, we're making sure the cameras are situated so that they are not recording victims in this case. I'm also going to note and reiterate that instruction. These statements are not under oath, nor are they subject to cross-examination. So, Ms. Blake, once you're ready, you can elicit any statement Mr. Douglas may have.
Your Honor, may the state remain seated.
Yes, you may, Ms. Blake.
And Mr. Douglas, I'll just let you know, the microphones are directional. So if you angle it kind of up under your chin, it will probably pick you up the best. And my intent, Your Honor, is simply to ask a few questions and have him then read his statement.
I think that's appropriate. Thank you, Ms. Blake.
Would you please state your name for the record?
Ron Douglas. That's D-O-U-G-L-A-S.
Mr. Douglas, which victim in this matter are you related to?
I am Tammy's father.
Have you prepared a statement today?
I have.
Would you please read your statement for the record?
Before moving to Idaho, she lived one block away. It was difficult for us when she moved. We'd had daily interactions with her and the children. After they moved, we drove to see them for all of the children's weddings and graduations. Our last visit in Idaho with them was in March of 2020. My wife made me promise to return and visit the kids after she passed away. My wife passed away last June. The tragedy of the case has harmed our family's relationship with the kids. I will remain open to rebuilding a relationship with them. It makes me angry, and it destroys me to know Tammy was treated how she was. I find it comforting to know that Tammy is resting peacefully in Utah, buried alone and near her beloved mother.
Thank you, Mr. Douglas.
All right, you can go ahead and step down, Mr. Douglas, and I'll have the state call its next victim for an impact statement.
Your Honor, the next victim to present an impact statement will be Kay Woodcock.
Very well.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Wood.
Thank you. Ms. Woodcock, we know you've already testified in this case, but can you remind the jury which victim you were related to?
I am related to J.J. Vallow. He is my grandson, and Tylee Ryan is my step-niece.
Thank you. Did you prepare a statement, a victim impact statement today?
Yes.
Will you please read that for the jury?
Sure. Today is an incredibly difficult and bittersweet day. I am filled with pride as I remember and speak about what an amazing grandson we had, and grief-stricken at speaking about how devastated I am at his loss. I stand here today, well, I sit here today, try and explain the immense pain that me and everyone in my family continues to endure daily. But how do I do that? What words carry the strength and impact to really ensure you feel the joy and love that JJ created and the impact of his death? There aren't any. No words can truly describe and fully demonstrate the depth of pain his death has created in our hearts and our lives. The loss of a grandchild is immensely painful under normal circumstances for any grandparent. The death of a grandchild at the hands of another brings pain that is indescribable. If you remember, JJ was born with the name Kanan Todd Trahan. He was born May 25th, 2012. He would have celebrated his 12th birthday just a few short days ago. I will call him Kanan while I talk about his first year of life, because that is who he was then. He was born a fighter, 10 weeks premature, weighing in at a tiny but mighty 2 pounds and 14 ounces. From minutes of being born, he was transferred to a hospital with a neonatal intensive care unit where he spent weeks fighting to grow. He was about 2 hours old when I saw him for the first time. Seeing him, I knew he was my grandson. He was the mirror image of my son, Todd, his biological father. Todd has always loved him and always will. Kanan's death has changed his life forever. While he was in the NICU, I was only able to see him for a few minutes at a time until I was notified he would be released to us within days. 25 years since I had a new baby at home and never a preemie with all their special needs. Larry and I didn't hesitate immediately. We said yes. The only place we wanted him to be was home with us. The night before he was discharged, I spent the night in a little room next to the NICU, talking to nurses, learning things that our little preemie grandbaby would need. The next day, it was time to leave. The nurse brought a wheelchair in and said, "Have a seat. We'll get you out of here." I looked at her, perplexed. I said, "I don't need a wheelchair. I can walk." She let me know that it was hospital policy. I sat in the wheelchair, took Kanan in my arms, and was wheeled out of the hospital like a new mama. I felt so much pride for this little baby who had not only overcome being born 10 weeks early, but also being born with illicit substance in his tiny little body. He was ready to come home well before he was expected, and my pride in him knew no bounds. We knew then that he was a champion and so special. That day began an amazing experience of raising our cherished little man. While Kanan had been in the NICU, he spent much time hooked up to machines and monitors that he didn't get to get snuggled all day, every day, like a typical newborn. The noises and routines of the NICU were gone, and it was such a huge change for him. His first night home, I bathed him. He cried so hard, and I cried along with him. My heart was so heavy with the disadvantages he was experiencing through no choice of his own. My husband, Larry, who is Pawpaw, asked me to give Kanan to him. He placed Kanan on his bare chest and wrapped his robe around him, gently breathing on his head until he stopped crying and fell asleep. It became a daily occurrence, part of our routine. He would hold him for hours so Kanan would feel loved, comforted, and secure. I saw my husband in a new light, seeing what type of daddy he was to a newborn. It was like Kanan made us young newlyweds. Larry jumped in feet first and did all the things a new father should and more. It made our relationship grow and gave us new strength. Kanan was our strength and we were his comfort. His first 6 months, we went to countless doctor appointments for his host of medical problems. We went to appointments with doctors for his heart, kidney, urology problems, speech, occupational therapists, and regular pediatricians for the things that every baby does. We were always on the move, going from one doctor to another, constantly working to ensure he thrived and grew. That, along with loving him, was our number one priority. At each appointment, it was pretty much guaranteed I would cry. It hurt so badly to see everything he was experiencing, not only from being born prematurely with drugs in his system. The decision was made to place Kanan with Charles and Lori after they approached us with their desire to have a child of their own. We agonized over the decision, but knew from our past interactions with them that it was the right one. Charles and Lori were granted custody a few short months later. It was then Kanan became JJ. It was happy and devastating at the same time. We loved raising him. We gave all our love and energy, ensuring he grew, thrived, and knew what unconditional love. That time was priceless, and his growth and milestones were evidence of our love for him. But we knew this was the best decision for his future. To have siblings and access to the types of schools and services we didn't have available in Lake Charles. When he left, I felt a grief that can only be compared to the grief of losing someone to death, which is now a feeling we all know too well. We barely made it 30 days Before we were standing on Charles' steps, ready to love on our baby, when the door opened, there he was in his little baby walker. I saw tears in his eyes at seeing us, right along with the huge toothless grin. It was clear that he missed us too. Before I could take a step, Larry swooped him up in his arms, and at 11 months old, he wrapped his tiny arms around Larry, laying his head on him. The connection was still so strong. We never lost that special connection with our sweet little man, and we were always his love, comfort, and safety. It is soul-crushing that his energy and adventurous... Oh, goodness. Wait, hang on. I made it a few months before I had... Before I had to get to my JJ, so in November of 2014, I made my first trip to Hawaii, quickly returning once again in December with Larry. We would visit about every 4 to 5 months because it was such a long trip to Hawaii from Louisiana, one we were happy to make, and we stayed for as long as possible, normally 10 to 14 days. We needed to soak up as much JJ time as we could. I remember one trip in the winter of 2015. JJ stayed home with me while Charles and Lori went to church. I was making a big pot of gumbo. I had to bring a little bit of Louisiana to Charles, and JJ was excited to help me. We pulled up a stool, and he poured in ingredient after ingredient. I can still see him standing next to me, intently pouring chicken broth in the pot. Afterwards, he climbed on the counter and just watched. Taking it all in, it is a memory that I will always cherish and dearly hold on to. During our visits, Charles or Lori would comment on how JJ would do things with us that were a stark contrast for them. He always awoke at the crack of dawn, never sleeping any later. When visiting, we would have JJ sleep with us. He would sleep until 9 or 10 o'clock, which astonished them. There was never a doubt. He had an innate and unbroken attachment to us. Each visit, no matter where they lived, Lori always expressed her deep appreciation that we gave them the greatest gift ever. That is just one part of why this causes so much pain. It is a betrayal that can't be explained. JJ was incredibly smart. He was reading on a middle school level by the time he was 4. I remember being in a store with him on the aisle with eye drops. And there he was reading off the labels, Visine, Systane, antihistamine, one long word after another. I hadn't seen him do that before, and I was blown away. He was brilliant. He would occasionally stumble on a syllable, but we took the time to go through and help him figure it out. But wow, the amount of awe I was in still makes me smile and feel the same pride I did that day. As he got a little older, he was enrolled in a private academy in Arizona, which focused on every aspect of educating and empowering children like JJ. He loved his school, and they loved him. It was there where it was discovered another level of brilliance JJ possessed. I remember when Charles told us he was a math savant, he could calculate anything. I continually wonder what he would have become, what type of man would he have become? Not only was JJ smart, but he was also fun, a very contented child, healthy, compassionate, and empathetic. JJ didn't show his empathy and compassion with hugs and kisses. In fact, you had to chase him down for those kisses. Instead, he showed his empathy and compassion with gentle touches and soft tones when he spoke. He would constantly stop to ask people if they were okay, if he could see they were hurt. His world was fascinating and exciting due to his huge imagination. He would put on concerts for his stuffed animals under our enormous tree, playing the drums on buckets, pots, and pans. The joy he exuded and shared can't be measured. I loved watching him, taking him in, and seeing how he approached the world. I never got enough of him. Now I've had all I will for the rest of my life, and only have memories. When Charles and Lori married, Tylee was 3 years old. She was the most precious, blonde-haired, blue-eyed little girl. Tylee was an absolute mama's girl, which there was never a doubt. I was thrilled to have a new niece, especially one as sweet as her. Larry and I were driving to Austin, Texas to visit them on one of many visits, and we passed a roadside stand selling swings made from old tires. I saw one that was a horse complete with a saddle and stirrups. I grabbed Larry's arm and said, "Stop, we have to get that for Tylee." Her brother Colby and stepbrothers Cole and Zach were always around her. She needed something just for her, and she loved it. Tylee was 9 years old when JJ became her little brother. She loved him so incredibly much, and he loved her right back. She doted on him, and he loved every minute of attention he got from his big sister. That love is displayed in the last photo taken of them together at Yellowstone, both grinning and hugging each other. As a big sister, Tylee would put notes on her bedroom door, one being, "Do not enter." As you can assume, even though JJ could read and interpret words and their meanings, it didn't mean he listened. After all, isn't that what little brothers do? He would burst into her room. She would laugh, tease, and tell him to get out. I think she did it on purpose just to joke and play with them. It was hilarious to see them interact and warmed our hearts seeing them together. JJ adored our niece, Maddie, on her 8th birthday in October of 2020. We were celebrating and singing happy birthday to her. The glow of the candles shining on her face, the huge grin that kids get during the singing hit me like a truck. I took the keys from Larry and went to the car and just bawled until I could compose myself enough to rejoin the party. It was the moment I knew that JJ didn't get his 8th birthday song, and it broke me. It was just so wrong. He didn't get to have that joy and feeling of love and celebration of his birthday. It is now grief that we are confronted with yearly. A stark and blaring reminder that we are never going to be able to celebrate that joy with him again. We never know when one of those moments will hit, but I can tell you there have been too many situations in the past few years where we were slammed with the fact that JJ won't hit another milestone. JJ loved school, loved his families, friends, and cousins, especially his cousin Braxy, Brandon Boudreaux's oldest son. Those two had such a special bond and love for each other. There were so many lives he touched that filled the immense pain and loss of him being gone. Four of our grandchildren, near JJ's age, often tell us how they love and miss him. It is heartbreaking to have a conversation with an 11 or 12-year-old. How do you make them feel okay about it or safe? So, yes, this is our life now, trying to comfort our other grandchildren while they try to comfort us. The constant question remains, who would he have become? What kind of man would he have been? Would he be a famous scientist with incredible math skills? Would he be, what would his amazing imagination have bloomed into? Would he have been the next Albert Einstein, Steve Jobs, Tim Burton, Elon Musk? We will never know. But we do know how incredibly special he was to us and now to countless others just by looking around this room. I can't express just how much I wish I could have more time to create memories with him and with Charles. There's a hole in my heart and the hearts of every member of my family that can never be filled and will remain for the rest of my life. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. The state can call its next victim for an impact statement.
Next, we'll have Matthew Douglas, Your Honor.
Very well.
Good morning.
Morning.
Can you please state your full name and then spell your last name?
It's Matthew Ronald Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S.
Thank you. And if you wouldn't mind, would you pull your microphone up just a little bit? Thank you very much. Would you tell the jury who you're here to talk about today?
I'm here to talk about my sister, Tammy.
Thank you. Did you prepare a statement?
Yes, I did.
Would you please read that statement at this time?
October 19th, 2019. For me, that is when this tragedy starts, but it is by no means its actual beginning. For me, and my own segment of the Douglas clan, I can speak to the pain that started on that date and how it only grew as more and more things in our lives were upended. To those I speak to, I have come into this ordeal far into the timeline of things and have the thankful luxury of hindsight and having information neatly presented or as neat as life can possibly hand you in these circumstances. You're all on the outside looking in. For those of us directly affected, who you'll hear from or may have already, we're finally getting to let our voices in some capacity finally be heard in a meaningful manner. And we lived it often, minute to minute, hour to hour, day to day. For my little family, which for a family of 10, it's not little. And especially for me, it has been a nightmare that you feel never ends. A continual cascading escalation of what's next. Every time I felt, I started to grasp an element of control, if such a thing can exist, of my grief over the loss of my oldest sister, something new came along and ripped it open. Hearing from your siblings that your brother-in-law has remarried and kept it from your family weeks after the fact. That's painful. Hearing the day after our family Christmas party, the first without her, that her body had been exhumed, and at the time not knowing the depth of why, that is gut-wrenching. And then the world goes upside down and topsy-turvy further, like you're being caught in a cheap holiday snow globe, thrown about and feeling like everything is obscured. Missing kids? Wait, there were kids? Now my brother-in-law and his new bride have fled from Idaho to Hawaii for what? And everybody at this point knows the evidence presented, the details big and small, many I still can't wrap my head and my heart around. The chain of events more clearly than I need rehash. Things happened so fast. We often learned of things from news or social media before we could be contacted formally by law enforcement. I always felt sorry for the moments that happened to whichever detective or member of the prosecutor's office we'd hear from, because news moves fast these days, and it is often far outside their control to warn us before we learn of it. From heartless media jackals looking for a sensational story. Thankfully, there's still good people that still exist in that profession too. And as unorthodox as it may seem to find a silver lining and small blessings for, it is kind-hearted, truth-seeking journalists who didn't blindside us and the victims' families, or think we were just a quick quote to misuse to their ends. Because finding out things in real time that directly impacted and destroyed your family was never enjoyable. Finding out how much deeper the rabbit hole went in this with no consideration for our pain and the continued impact on us all. I don't wish that on anyone. And yes, I said destroyed, because losing Tammy, who to me was the emotional heart and glue of our siblings group, was a slow and steady destruction of elements of our family as we knew it. Mom was so heartbroken that it only seemed to accelerate and compound her chronic health issues, especially her 30 plus year battle with leukemia. We lost her last year, just a little over a week away from now. It'll be a year on June 8th, as she seemed to finally be ready to lay down her proverbial sword and shield after a tumultuous spring of emotions tied to it all. I still remember the last normal conversation I had with her just 3 days before Mother's Day, when she went into the hospital for the last time and then was sent home on palliative hospice care until she passed. Mom isn't here today, and by no means am I her voice in anything, nor is anyone. She was uniquely her own. I can speak to the impact I saw secondhand on her of losing Tammy. We often joked in the last few years that I was her emotional support human, because we both understood the things about a life of chronic pain and health issues. In some of our tougher conversations, we were open and honest about how much her being gone affected us. Mom missed her dearly every damn day. I miss her, but not the pain and the heartbreak she was in at the end, because she had long ago earned that reprieve. Tammy's kids cut off contact with a lot of the Douglas side of the family for years after everything, and in some cases still do, in choosing to defend their father. I stand by their freedom to associate. Our freedom to associate is important to us as a society, but it is often a measure of a person by who they choose to or not to associate with. having them not standing by their mother hurt. If they ever want to rectify that position or reconnect, they know where their uncle lives or how to find out. I'm not hard to find. Family ties were broken. To put it simply, the loss of Tamley revealed true natures and behaviors of family that perhaps previously were dismissed, hidden, or ignored blatantly. This isn't a place of grievances, but to explain the impact losing your sibling's heart and glue has. When masks come off and people are so true and real to themselves, for better or worse, that some recognize that things aren't healthy and it's time to fix that. It's painful creating boundaries with people in your life that you're really raised to believe you should fight like hell to protect and love dearly. But it's also healing, at least on the outside of the boundary, but things will never be the same. And Tylee and JJ, two kids I never knew existed prior to all of this, and to who me and my family are now forever tied in tragedy to. I have kids close to their ages to say, even though I'm not related to them, I'm not impacted, would be lying. Larry and Kay and all of your family, for me and mine, our hearts have hurt with you, as I've seen yours hurt with ours over Tammy. We've been grateful to the fact without your tireless love for those children, would we even be here now? And you've been a voice for my sister when often others wouldn't have. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor, the state would next call Annie Cushing.
Okay, very well.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Rixon, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ma'am, will you please state and spell your full name for the record?
Annie Cushing, C-U-S-H-I-N-G.
Can you please explain for the record, are you related to one of the victims in this case?
I am. I'm Tylee Ryan's aunt, Joseph Ryan's sister.
And as you came here today, did you come with a statement that you'd like to share with the jury?
I did.
Do you have that with you?
I do.
Would you like to go ahead and read that now, please?
Sure. Thank you. I remember getting a call from my brother Joe in 2002 to tell me he had gotten married, converted to the LDS faith, and was expecting a baby. Joe had been the perennial bachelor of the family, in his 40s, never married, and no kids. So this was very surprising news. He wanted to fly me out to meet his new wife. They were both so excited to be having a little girl. They had already picked out her name and were well ahead of schedule, buying the best of everything this little baby would possibly need. A couple years later, we vacationed together as families. Joe was the quintessential first-time father. Every developmental milestone Tylee achieved convinced him all the more she was clearly a child prodigy. He was also convinced she looked just like him and would find excuses to refer to her as daddy's soul girl. Truth be told, Tylee actually looked more like her mom's side of the family, which I never told Joe. But on the inside, she was so her dad. She was always dressed like a princess and had an arsenal of hairstyles that she chose from each day. But once she learned to talk, she would let you know what she wanted and was prepared to negotiate those desires like she was finalizing a legally binding contract. Even as a little girl, Tylee knew what she wanted, and we were all her humble servants. Fast forward to 2018. I flew out to Phoenix after my brother's death and was able to reconnect with Tylee. She was intelligent, clever, funny, sarcastic, and had the voice of an angel. She would just walk around the house singing. She would eventually take her love for singing to the karaoke platform, Smule, leaving behind breadcrumbs for those of us who loved her and the thousands who would come to love her. But I could also tell she was depressed. And I desperately wanted to reach her to let her know I wanted to be in her life as much as she would allow. We just happened to connect on pop culture. We'd reference ridiculous memes and viral videos, and her mom had no idea what we were talking about. So Tylee and I would take turns explaining the references. It was the first spark of connection, our common ground. Our second was over questions she had about what I did for a living. Oddly enough, her dad and I were both analysts, so I think it felt safer for for her to ask about my world than her dad's, since any mention of her dad was a trigger for her mom, and she hadn't seen her dad in a while. I even told her that if nothing else, she definitely had the personality of an analyst. Facts were very important to her. Case in point, her mom, who was braggadocious and never let facts get in the way of a good story, was telling me about one of Tylee's academic achievements. And Tylee corrected her on a relatively inconsequential detail her mom had overstated. I teased her afterwards and was like, dude, who does that? You couldn't have just let that detail slide. And we had a good laugh. But to Tylee, I think if it wasn't accurate, it just wasn't meaningful. She was exacting, just like her dad. My last night in Phoenix, we were supposed to have a girls' night out, but her mom changed her mind and said she was going to bed. It turned out to be the best gift she could have given me because it was the first time on that trip Tylee and I actually had time alone to connect. We enjoyed some small talk and foraged for food, but then I took a calculated risk and decided to share some things that I thought were really special about her. First, let me say, I've watched a lot of true crime over the years and know the tendency of family members to apply a halo effect to their loved ones after they pass, especially if they were victims. But after I left, one of my adult kids reached out to me to see how I was doing. We had an extended text message exchange about my time in Phoenix, and I talked about that interaction, which memorialized it. I just happened to find it in the course of the case. And I was like, no one's going to believe this actually happened. Everyone's going to attribute this to the Dateline effect. So I've actually published it publicly. For context, I had shared details about some of the conflict in the home leading up to this snippet. I wrote, Tylee opened up to me the last night after Lola went to bed. I feel trapped. I connected with Tylee, but don't want anything to do with Lolo ever again. And for this next snippet, I had shared some details about an outburst Tylee had toward her mom after she had said something grossly inappropriate about her dad. I wrote, she was this angry, resentful, sarcastic teen the entire week. Then we talked alone, and she was putty. She was so sweet and genuinely responsive to the genuine positive feedback I gave her. There's a picture of Tylee floating out there where she has the same sweet smile I saw that night. It had a vulnerability to it. It's my favorite picture of her because here she was, this walled garden, and in that interaction, she let me in. Even if it was just a step past the threshold, that brief exchange was the highlight of that week for me. Since learning more about her story, even up to that point, I completely understand why Tylee wasn't quick to let anyone in. Excuse me. By sharp contrast, according to Alex Gilbert, the defendant's neighbor who testified, he said Tylee didn't like people. That's not true. She wasn't ever angry or disrespectful in any way toward me. And I was there less than a week. We got along swimmingly. Now, his reported follow-up statement about her not liking him, that tracks. She was not one to suffer fools. I also found out in that chat she loved New York City. That was my open door. So I lobbed the idea of flying her out for her 18th birthday over the fence, and it was a hit. As I said in that text exchange, I was done with her mom and her extremist beliefs, but I thought there was a chance I'd have the opportunity to develop a relationship with Tylee that wasn't dependent on her mom. I planned to show her the best views that tourists don't know about, walk the High Line together, get real pizza, take her to the rotating restaurant in Times Square with breathtaking 360 views of the city, and let her reconnect with my daughter, who she hadn't seen since she was little. Her 18th birthday couldn't have been further from the celebratory event I had imagined. Excuse me. As her remains had been recently discovered in the defendant's backyard. Getting back to our last time together. I want to be fair. The trip certainly wasn't all bad. There were also some very sweet moments between Tylee and her mom, moments of hilarity and a fun outing. I also didn't see anything concerning with JJ. Everyone was nurturing and protective of him. JJ, like his big sister, didn't let just anyone in. I had no idea if I'd be able to connect with him. I was fascinated by this little boy who had a wild imagination and the closest bond I've ever seen a child have with a dog. Bailey was his constant companion. But with JJ, as more of an outsider, your interactions felt more like moving alongside him rather than engaging directly. So I was looking for, any possibility of our worlds to kind of cross. To that end, one thing I noticed was JJ didn't just watch TV. It was like an immersive experience. He'd be talking to the characters, commenting, imitating sounds, especially explosions. He loved imitating explosions. So I tried to do the same thing, but kind of tamped down and on the DL. I would just look at the TV and comment at something outrageous, like, what? That's wild. So we were both just kind of yelling at the TV. Whether it was a connection or not, it at least made watching TV a lot more fun. But then this one time shortly after that, his mom and I were talking in the kitchen next to the island. It's germane to the story. As a function of JJ's autism and unbounding energy, he'd run in this one circuit, which included the area just on the other side of the island. And their house at that time was palatial, so it was a pretty significant circuit. But on one trip, he broke out of his circuit and without slowing down, ran into the kitchen and into me, throwing off my balance a bit because I wasn't expecting it. Without a word, he hugged me and kept on running. I stood there stunned and asked his mom, was that a drive-by hugging? I was so touched because it was the first discernible indicator that we connected. That night, as she was putting him down for bed, I heard him ask her, will Annie be here when I wake up? Again, we never interacted directly in any way, but he recognized presence. So like Tylee, I didn't know if our worlds would ever collide in any meaningful way, but I believe that love is a universal language that's somehow communicated between sincere hearts. Just a month after that visit, Tylee wrote in an Instagram post on her mom's birthday that she had, quote, won the lottery with this one as my mom. So I believe there was hope for them to one day be able to set up some healthier boundaries and find peace. But just 4 months after that post, to the day, that would all change. That was the day her mom met the defendant. It was the spark that eventually would set so many of our lives ablaze. This case has been death by a thousand cuts. Each detail that would come out over the past 4 years was just another cut. It's taken a toll on my family, my health, and my overall perspective. And it felt like the world had become a more dangerous place. Just a little peek behind the curtain. There was one time early in the case, Tylee and JJ were still missing and the city was in lockdown because of the pandemic and police were out en masse because of protests and riots in the city. It was like the whole world had gone mad, but I had gone for a run through Times Square, which looked like a ghost town with a sea of mental health billboards. When I passed a corner newsstand, there was a picture of Tylee and JJ on a magazine cover with a heart-grabbing headline. Seeing that against a backdrop of what looked like a post-apocalyptic landscape made it all the more surreal. But to be clear, it's still surreal. It always will be. If someone had told me in 2002 that in 20 years' time, Joe and Tylee would both be dead and I'd be swept up in a criminal case around Tylee's murder, I wouldn't have believed it. Tylee had her whole life ahead of her. She had dignity. She had dreams. She had goals. This defendant stole all of that. To close on a high note, a Greek philosopher once said, "The wheels of justice turn slowly, but grind exceedingly fine." I believe that has happened in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Your Honor, we've had a question raised. We might ask the marshal if there's a box of Kleenexes at the witness stand.
Sure. And Judge, could we have a sidebar for a minute as well?
Yes.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.